So, the topic of transforming intolerance and racism. And tonight is about mindfulness and the creative disruption of bias. And last week, Irina Weissman came as a guest teacher, and she took on the social dynamics of inequity and really got a little more into how privilege, and especially white privilege, works, but also just generally where we might experience more privilege by being part of a group and where we might be more excluded by being part of a more marginal group. And there's all sorts of examples we went through, like race is around, the variables around race appearance. So we know there's no such real genetic difference in race, but certainly we notice a difference in appearance that we attribute differences to. We look at gender, appearance, different types of physical or mental abilities, immigration status. We look at a whole bunch of places where oppression can play out, where there can be more privileged and less privileged groups. So this week we're picking up on bias. Okay, so a core insight of the Buddhist teaching is described in this formula. And on the back of your sheet, I have it written here. And this is something that appears very early on in Buddhism. And you see it's attributed to the Buddha as a core way he described the way to address the problem of suffering. So he said, this being that becomes, from the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not become, from the cessation of this, that ceases. And it's a description of conditioning, basically. That on the basis of some conditions coming into play, then there's results. And if those conditions aren't there, then those outcomes also change. And this was basic way of saying there are certain forms of suffering, the problem of human suffering, that actually we perpetuate in our condition. It's conditioning that brings them about. They're not fixed. They're not inherently this way. And therefore, it's why not try to learn how to change those conditions? And it's like, if you have this, it is a magic wand of sorts, but it's not a naive magic wand. We have to work within the conditions that are there. We can't just magically change all the conditions and have them be the way we want, but we can work within those conditions creatively. And this principle is really what the whole of the Dharma addresses. So, tonight we're going to look at intolerance and racism and bias as a prevalent, a very obvious form of suffering in our world that arises based on conditions and therefore can be changed. And I think that's really why I got happier and happier as I was preparing for tonight, because some things can feel, some social issues can feel quite intractable. And I'm not going to say racism is simple. It is complex. It is a complex problem, which makes it hard to look at where do we start dismantling it? And it's precisely the very complex problems that I feel that really deserve our attention. You know, others being climate change. That's a pretty complex problem. If we want to survive on this planet, perhaps we should take that on. Yeah? And I think if we want to survive on this planet with any kind of world that we can thrive in, which is what we're looking at the meditation, we really need to take on intolerance. You know? What kind of world are we creating? What kind of world are we creating to live in? So we all have creative agency in relationship, especially to our own hearts and minds. That's one place where we definitely have some creativity. So while we can get stuck by saying, I can't do anything, we are each instruments of change. And I want to actually really encourage us where we do have creative agency in our own hearts and minds. And then that can affect the world we create and how we participate in the world. I always like that the word for Buddha comes from a root that means awake. And the prospect of being awake I found pretty enticing. There's also the expression, ignorance is bliss, so there is the pull to just not know, especially when things are complex. It just can be overwhelming, and there can be the tendency just to shut down. And I want to ask us to put a little energy into tonight, staying open and staying awake. And the process of understanding more our conditioning and how to shape that conditioning, how to be creative within the process of conditioning, is considered an awakening process. And learning how conditioning works, waking up to how we have been conditioned and shaping that creatively, that is a process of waking up. And we're not either just totally awake or totally asleep. There's usually some kind of spectrum in there. So maybe we'll get a little more awake. I also like that process of awakening is also frequently described as becoming free. And the word, actually, we have vimala moksha. And moksha, vimoksha, freedom, that's also a very common description of why bother to practice Dharma teachings, is to become more free. And in relationship to undoing racism, liberation is a very evocative word as well. I'm going right back to one of the origins of the notion of racism being slavery in this country. You know, racism was contrived to support the economic device of slavery so that we could justify owning people as resources to generate wealth. Yeah? So liberation, it's important to really think of liberation, not just in psychological terms, but in real terms. You know, really how important it is that people are free. And there's all sorts of ways in which we can create a society where people are more or less free. And a lot of that's up for discussion in this presidential debate, so we have plenty to be interested in. Yeah? A lot around whether people, for example, get the value of their own work, their own labor. Yeah, is that something that they have some control over? So, stay sharp, everyone. It's going to be a big year. So, liberation. I think I really want to urge us to. Sometimes I think one of the dangers of Buddhist practice in the West is that it's been taken up by largely by people with privilege. So that has shaped the conversation about what the Dharma is about in the West. And often then it gets kind of limited to personal well-being in the sense of maybe the pursuit of happiness in a particular way that tends to be a bit more commodified or more about something I have. And I really want to challenge that notion tonight, that liberation, I believe that the Dharma is talking about liberation not just for an individual like stuck in a gated community trying to retain that liberation, but really that none of us is free until really we're all in conditions where we can thrive. And we can see the nervousness there is. The more there's income inequality, the more nervousness there is about holding on to something. You know? So I really believe that for us all to be free, we need to all be in a world where we can thrive, and we're not just looking out for my gain, for myself and my people and not for yours. Okay, so part one is understanding bias. Getting a better sense of the problem and our participation in it. And how does racism come into being? So I was looking back at a lot of, there's a lot out there. Actually, if you're interested in this topic, you really have no reason not to have plenty of resources. There's a tremendous amount of really good stuff out there. And looking at it all, I thought, oh, let's put it into this, let's
let's try to put it into this formula, this being that becomes. So how does bias come to be? Yeah. So this is up for improvement. So we're going to get through this, and I'm going to ask you what else you might see in terms of how the conditions come together. Yeah. So this is from a particular, this one version is going to be a little bit more from a neuroscience view. And then there's some other conditioning factors that are not on the sheet I want to bring up. But we could look at it from, okay, so starting with the process of biological evolution being, you may or may not believe in that, but let's just say we take that, it's got to start somewhere. Let's say let's take the process of biological evolution being, then the drive for survival takes form, right? It starts to become. And from the arising of that drive for survival, our particular psychophysical organism evolves. Yeah? And it arises. And then the primate brain, or our older brain, comes into being. And in that brain, there is the wiring for the fear and threat response that becomes. That's there. It becomes for when we're confronted with the unfamiliar. So it's a survival thing. And I saw a really great illustration of the brain recently. So if you hold up your hand, this is the primitive brain stem, you know, very early formation in our evolution. And the thumb is our limbic system. This is a very old part of the brain that generates the fight, freeze, arousal when we need to run. Yeah. So that, you just tuck that in, that's there in the brain. This is where a lot of very raw emotionality comes from. And then above that, in the fingers, we have the later evolution of the brain, the neocortex. The cortex is the later evolution, and that wraps around the older brain. And it looks like this. It's in the front here. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And this front part regulates Daniel Siegel, who's over at UCLA, describes this as the upstairs brain and the downstairs brain. And the upstairs brain regulates the downstairs brain. So the upstairs brain is where we get more complex functioning, like planning, reasoning. We can discern our emotions for what's wise. Yeah. So the upstairs brain helps regulate the lower brain. When we're agitated or stressed or confront the unfamiliar, the upstairs gets a little agitated, and we can actually get agitated to the point where, as Daniel Siegel calls it, we flip our lid. We basically lose it. And this kind of discernment, this wise discernment, gets lost. And we're really down to like very primitive functioning. It's all about fight, flight, or survival. That's what is functioning. Yeah? So you can probably feel this, right, as you start to get maybe in your situation. And for us, now this was maybe designed for more when you had to run from a mountain lion or something. But for us now, psychological threats have take on the intensity as if our life is really dependent on it, right? So if someone starts telling you, I don't know, that you did something you didn't do that's quite serious, they can get pretty agitated and upstairs, right? And you can just start lashing out. Like, no, I didn't! You know, just like, you can get out of control emotionally. So that's a part of what we work with. Okay. So unchecked, the arising of survival-motivated fear. So if we confront the unfamiliar, there's no working with that, then the limbic system, and especially something called the amygdala in there, starts firing. That's like anxiety, fear. Fear starts happening. Yeah. Like actually feeling like something bad is going to happen. And from that, we can start to try to cope very quickly. This is all preconscious. I want to tell you, this is all preconscious. So, the sense of us, me in here, and the threat out there starts to form, yeah, when we go into this fear response. And what's interesting is this can happen in 1/5 of a second. This is a preconscious response of what is me or... like me, the safe, and what's unsafe. Yeah? And pre-consciously, what we go for is what's immediately available, which is physical data. So physical appearance, we start to attribute categorization to, which is why race becomes so apparent. Race, color, physical appearance becomes very quickly something that we then divide around. And then, from the categories of us and them, all sorts of associations that have been pre-learned come flooding in. So all this is, again, pre-conscious. You may be somebody that consciously thinks all people should be treated equally. And if you're confronted in a stressful situation where you feel unsafe or it's unfamiliar, you might start having this all start happening. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Then all the associations come in. Well, where do these associations come in from? Well, images we've seen through the media, which if you take a critical look at media, they're very biased images, yeah. Where people have certain racial groupings, apparent racial groupings, you know. How many times do you really get? You can even see it like with Jeremy Lin, the basketball player, media attention was really about like the cognitive dissonance that this Asian guy could be a basketball player, right? And all the kind of messages around that. Or in messages we get like with Hurricane Katrina, yeah? White people needing help, looking for safety, black people looking for help, being characterized as thugs, literally in the media, right? So all these things are associations that we have taken in, whether we believe or agree with them or not, we're absorbing them. And there may be more conscious conditioning from our family, trying to keep the in-group in and the out-group out. Yeah. I mean, I can think of very specific, very biased, prejudiced things that my parents have told me out of ignorance, trying to keep me safe. Yeah. So I don't know where you might have gotten messages, but it's not conflating. So categories of us and them being aversion and racial bias become these messages. And we automatically have preference for the groups we identify with over different groups. This is what happens in this quick response. Okay? And because, again, we're still in the unconscious, which is all happening really fast, then from the arising of racial bias, that can actually translate into how we treat others, our behavior. Yeah. If we're not awake to this process, it can come out in our behavior. The limbic brain, it's very impulsive. Emotion is very impulsive, driving us to do things. A research that has found that when confronted with a racial other in a group setting, anxieties can cause people to do very strange things. When setting up a room, they can arrange seats farther apart than they would be if they don't have a group with different racial groupings that they find other in it. Yeah. So this is not conscious. Someone's not saying, I'm going to put the chairs further apart, but that can start manifesting externally. We can start to over-anticipate disagreement and conflict, which is interesting. And we can see other even more manifest results. So in our collective institutions, so there's a lot of dialogue now about what's happening in police departments, right? Unequal results in housing, unequal results in education. And we just start to see this very quick process start to manifest in what the mind, you know, Buddhism says the mind perceives, and then the world, we create the world, right? So from this mind, if it's a mind based in fear and division, we then act and create a world that represents fear and division. So that's a conditioned development of racial bias. And I think one point I want to make is that all that happens unconsciously. And I think that's a very important thing that we're learning. It's important to take on. Because where there's less room for transformation is in the discussion where a person says, or we just take the position, I'm not racist. Yeah?
which is a very closed-ended, it's like a kind of a very closed position. Because actually what might be going on is there might be some conditioning that, and actually we know that these things happen very quickly. There might be conditioning that causes racial bias, that if we just declare we're not racist, or if we can't even think about it, it's so horrific to think that there might be something racially biased going on with us that we don't look, then we don't really get the chance to be aware or wake up to the messages we've received or how we might be conditioned, because we actually can work with that. So some other causes is just the competition for resources. So this is something that's been happening for thousands of years. You know, scarce resources, we compete. So we try to look out for an in-group and maybe, you know, try to keep the out-group out there. So discussions of building a wall sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. A wall along the border with Mexico. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the fomenting of the idea that we're in an economic recession, right? So there's a shortage of jobs. So there becomes this framing that them are taking jobs away from us, right? That's just one example. And so that you can see play out in all sorts of ways. Now, I think these days what we're getting, and this has been pointed out a lot, we're getting a lot more, the kind of transformation we can do is in the area of unconscious bias. John Powell, who does a lot of writing on bias, talks about how there was an old version of explicit, people saying really racially charged things without a thought, right? An old order of racial discrimination is very explicit and consciously hostile towards the other. At this point, it's not that that doesn't still exist. Actually, people have been saying that it's interesting how that can so easily re-become fomented if there's some inflammatory instigation. It can very quickly come up. But for a lot of us, we're in a place where It's more this new form of racism, which is around the more unconscious forms of bias that we still carry, and which then become implicit in our systems. So it's in our criminal justice system, even though there's laws that are explicitly make discrimination illegal. Yeah, there's still implicit bias that is functioning. So we need to be a little more sophisticated in this new order of racism. So that's part one, and I'd say that Buddhism is really, we can see in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which is another formulation of this becoming, and how things come into being and how we can dismantle them, that we want to look at how suffering comes to be, how it becomes conditioned, and it can be kind of unpleasant, but the purpose is transformational, yeah? So there's some energy that is put towards actually turning towards suffering when we may want to avoid suffering generally, to understand it, have empathy for it. I don't believe that anyone, I don't know, this might be, I can't know what's in every single person's mind, but generally I would like to say that I don't think people, their intent is to create suffering. I think their intent is to be well. And therefore, they go into these strategies, you know, like trying to watch out for my own, me and mine, right? I don't know if they're, abject cruelty comes quite far. There's a lot of distance between this abject cruelty and misguided strategies. So I just want to say one last thing about this turning towards this dynamics of being curious about how research is really showing about that unconscious bias is really very much at play with us, is the notion of color blindness. And I think Buddhists are particularly susceptible to the notion of color blindness. I've heard people use this I'm beyond duality kind of sense as a way to avoid the whole, just basically discount that. Oh, why should we even be talking about racism? That just, or if we talk about racism, we're just creating racism, which is, I think, a rather simplistic statement.
Mm-hmm.
So, just looking at the Four Noble Truths, we want to look at there is the truth of suffering, which is in the form of racial discrimination. It comes about as a result of conditions rooted in ignorance. That's classic Dharmic practice. What we're finding in research is that color blindness causes people not to look at the dynamics of racial bias, and therefore to be inactive about it. And I guess there's a hope that if we don't say there's racism, it's kind of like magical thinking. If we say there's no racial bias functioning, it just won't be functioning or something. I mean, I wonder what the logical conclusions of that are. One would have to think that through. But also, we know that as young as 6 months, children do see apparent physical difference, so they see race. Mm-hmm. And what we can do is wake up to not just categorizing and stereotyping groups of people, having one person represent a whole bunch of our fantasies about them, a whole group. And by waking up to that, we can transform. So part two will be about mindfulness and the transformation. I'd like to invite us to maybe turn and talk to a couple people next to you about what then, having what we just discussed, what then does that say to you about the quiz you just took and the questions on the quiz, right? And how you answered them. So the first part, remembering the first few questions are about what we consciously believe. So it's very possible to be consciously very much for fair treatment of people. And simultaneously, unconsciously be susceptible to perpetrate racial bias behavior. It's possible to have both of those happening simultaneously. That's one of the implications of what I'm saying. So if you could just turn and talk to somebody about just what you get curious about. You don't have to reveal your results, but just from what I'm saying, also from the quiz, like using I statements a bit rather than just analyzing the world and everybody else would be helpful. And then we'll do that for just about 10 minutes and have a break, and then we'll come back to the mindfulness part. Okay, so usually I have more time. I'd be interested to hear what came up in the groups, but I'm going to move on, so I'll leave you just with the problem. So part two is about, well, what about part where it says, this not becoming, that does not become. From the cessation of this, that ceases. So part two being the transformational part. So I described something that describes the problem, but there's all sorts of resources, assets we have to draw on that can be used to make the transformation. And increasingly, there's research showing that mindfulness is actually a great tool for transforming these habituated conditioned responses to encountering the unfamiliar. And I would say both mindfulness and compassion, actually, there's also quite a bit coming in now about empathy. And so this is the other thing we have that's possible, is empathy. Yeah, so if we're talking about previously the whole process of making an other that we don't relate to as human, there are practices, there's things we can do that can develop our capacity for empathy and connection. So these are things that will make a difference. So one most important thing about mindfulness that gets described is continuity of purpose. So in the midst of a world where there's a lot going on, have some sort of vision or purpose for the kind of world we want to help create, or the kind of person or contribution we want to make as a person that we can grow into. So if what's been found is if we actually have take on some attempt to undo bias, we'll have a better chance at, obviously, undoing bias. we can't stop bias from emerging. As I said, it's a conditioned response, but we can shape the conditioning that can then shape how it starts to show up. We can actually change what shows up, and I know this for myself. it helps to have support, but you can, there's always things you can do with your own heart and mind. And I'm going to talk about some things. And next week, we're actually going to have a little more experience of making some shifts, especially in this process of when we get a little bit activated, how to pivot to a place where we have more calm and we can respond more creatively. And yeah. So if we have some continuity of purpose, we can stay awake to, especially when we're walking into situations where we might be encountering difference, to stay awake in that process and notice what happens and more creatively, you know, notice what's happening. So mindfulness can be practiced at different levels, and there's one level is the personal, and then there's more interpersonal awareness. And again, I think sometimes the way Buddhism gets taught or Dharma tools get taught, it's very much interned, and there's much more power to mindfulness about how we relate with each other and in the world. And I feel that if you're going to make full use of the tool, that's, it's good to expand what the tool can do, the power of mindfulness. But just to start with, it's quite something to start at the, in the personal ecosystem, being aware of the body, sensations, emotions, and thoughts. So this is like classic mindfulness practice, whether that's being aware of breath and body, or Satipatthana, which is more specifically being aware of body sensations, how feelings condition emotions, you know, what happens when we feel uncomfortable, what can happen. And then to look at our view and thoughts that get conditioned. So that all that practice is fantastic to bring to this whole area of habituated conditioned response, yeah? When we're encountering the unfamiliar. So we can just look at that whole way in which the process of bias unfolds and see that we can interrupt that. We can actually interrupt that process. We can awaken to the fact that maybe the limbic system starting to fire signals of vigilance, or the heartbeat's starting. Now, if you're aware of the body, you might notice your heartbeat getting faster. Yeah? You might notice your jaw clenching. There's information you can get very early on that you can then actually creatively calm down. So you can learn how to calm down. So a lot of the whole half of meditation is learning how to calm down, basically. It's actually got an official name, samatha. Called calm down. So a tremendous skill. And we know that stress exacerbates prejudice. So by calming down, it shifts. Calming down will shift that interpretation, in group, out group, all that dynamic, just calm down. Awareness of thoughts, if it's happening, just be aware, oh, that's just a thought. Is it even my thought? You know, did I just pick that up from some horrible news program? You know, I think the important thing is to learn how to steer clear of shame and blame. It doesn't help. Like, we are, these things have, we have been exposed to all sorts of very perverse ideas about each other. So the fact that that thought arises, it's like, that will happen. It might be, you can use the upset more to get curious about how to transform towards more empathy. But steer clear of just getting harsh on yourself for the fact that that thought even arose. These thoughts do arise. And, you know, it happens not just between, let's say, a lot of stuff gets written about whites towards darker-skinned people, right? That's where you get a lot of what you hear about. But within groups of people of color, it's the same dynamics going on. There's an article, a friend of mine, Rona Fernandez, wrote a piece in this anthology that was really beautiful about this, but how she's working with it. So this is true for, I know for me it's interesting to wake up and many, it's, when I said it's complex, you know, it's these kinds of ways that we can divide happen in so many different dimensions. And she says, as the American-born daughter of Filipino immigrant parents, I've struggled for years to overcome the various forms of racism at play in my life. Not just those directed at me, but those I find within myself. I've found that overcoming my own internalized racism has been my first step towards a life less constrained by race. For many people of color, this type of racism is subtle but powerful, affecting our self-esteem in ways we are often not even aware. And it's not just about accepting ourselves, it's also about accepting our differences with other people, including other people of color. And it's in this book, Are We Born Racist? New Insights from Neuroscience and Positive Psychology. And she's got a beautiful piece called Me and My Nose, Diana Fernandez. So what they found was while this amygdala flight vigilance response can be spiked in studies where whites were seeing unfamiliar black faces in just 30 milliseconds of subconscious exposure, what's interesting is that with longer exposure, with longer time to actually take in that information, the amygdala activity could calm right down. So that's kind of interesting. So yeah, we have this conditioned response, but if your purpose is actually to see a human being as a human being, not as this associative category of otherness, actually that can calm down, and it's possible to shift that reaction in 525 milliseconds, which is when we start to become conscious, when the consciousness comes in, which is very encouraging. So it takes energy. This is, you know, we have to learn how to ride through initial discomfort in some of these interactions to be able to get past that first function, which our brain just does, categorizing, to seeing the actual human being. So also studies and practices of empathy are really powerful to actually see that there's another human being there. And Sangha Rakshita, he talks about awareness of people in a way that I think really fits for this. So he's a founder of this tradition. And he says, if we are aware of people at all, we are usually aware of them not as human beings, but as things or objects out there. In other words, we are aware of them as physical bodies impinging on our physical bodies. The way of being aware of other people is not enough. This way of being aware of other people is not enough. We must become aware of them as persons. And so this was him just saying generally, practice awareness of other people. Practice mindfulness for other people. Look up. So there is a lot of positive evidence that just having contact, meaningful contact with people that are different, like actually bridging that gulf of otherness through actual meaningful contact, will shift bias. So it replaces our ideas with lived experience of actual people that no longer have the burden of representing all the media images we've ever had and all the ideas about them we've ever had. Apparently school, I feel people that are parents in a multiracial environment have a good chance. Apparently schools are really wonderful places to begin to try to give lots of opportunities to reach across the divide and meet with other parents, you know, actually form meaningful relationships across difference. So I would wonder about where that might be possible for any of us to try that. So it's actually meaningful. You know, not like just approaching someone like a token and saying, will you educate me about your people? But, you know, a meaningful relationship, one where something authentic can happen. And often having a common goal is something that supports that. So people have worked on election campaigns or building a structure in a park. And, you know, all sorts of people might come up. In that, we're confronting the stereotypical images we've been given. So all these practices can make a difference. If you're interested, there's a kind of fun, MTV has this 7-day cleanse. So MTV is
joined up with John Powell, who's a very deep race scholar. They created the bias cleanse. There's one around race, there's one around gender. And it's, they send you some kind of fun little reminders. It's something you might want to, it's good to share. They try to make it very accessible, so it might be fun to share with people that haven't had much chance to look at issues like bias. There's little quizzes you can take. There's a really great implicit bias quiz that I would recommend you take if you've never taken one before. It can be very instructive about how we do whole unconscious bias. And they have lots of little tips and fun practices in there. But I'll just end by saying for tonight, like just becoming more aware of what's going on with your own heart and mind. You can calm it down, get curious with empathy about who is this other human being across any kind of difference. And getting and you know, really learning to celebrate difference, I think. Let's see if that's the alternative from fear, is to really celebrate difference, to get interested in it. What an amazing thing that we're not all exactly the same. Okay, so thanks for coming. It's a couple minutes past 9 now, so I want to end respecting people's time. So I wonder about ending with just a dedication of merits, and I'm happy to stick around if people want to talk a little bit more. We can, but the people that need to go can feel free to go. I'll just take a moment to dedicate the merits. Which is just a way of sharing anything good that might have happened with all beings. So just appreciating the energy we've put into waking up a little bit, or maybe a lot, around how the suffering of racial bias perpetuates. Just appreciating any curiosity you've brought, just the fact you're willing to be here. Just noticing for a moment what your heart longs for, what your heart really longs for. I know I have a very deep, deep longing for people to be respected, for difference to be respected, for people to be celebrated, so I'm not sure what your longing is, just noticing. And may that be nourished, that longing, and may it benefit many, many beings.